This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent and diverse campus community radio from Simon Fraser University.
Hello and welcome to the show. Boris Hassan here with you for the next 30 minutes. On this edition of Viewpoints, Friday, June 21st is National Indigenous Peoples Day. A documentary on Indigenous astronomy expert Wilfred Buck hit the screens in Kingston this week. Filmmaker, director, and producer Lisa Jackson will be with us.
When I read his life story, I had to bring it to the screen. So what people will see is a film that I think is ultimately hopeful and that takes you into the life of someone who has made a huge impact bringing Indigenous science to communities and helping people heal.
A UBC study probes management retreat from Sumas Prairie to restore Sumas Lake, but the mayor calls it ridiculous.
Well, this is the most valuable farmland in the country, the most productive. The fact is, where do we find arable land like that anywhere else in the province?
An art tour on the southeast coast of Nova Scotia dares to be different, as a local glassmaker wants to transform the Queen's County into an arts destination.
We need to be different. Everybody does craft sales, you know, up and down the shore, right? It's like one after another. No, I think it's really important. And locally, I think it's important.
And the Senate of Canada report urges action to protect our soils. If nothing is done by 2050, we could very well run out of productive farmlands.
We want the government to acknowledge that soil is a national asset that needs to be protected.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
We first land out east, where Liverpool stained glass artist Scott Slesser wants the Queen's Coast art tour to be a memorable one. He also wants the map for the tour to be just as unforgettable and useful. The map comes with instructions on how to turn it into a paper airplane. But Slesser doesn't only want people to fly the map, he wants people to unfold it to reveal the many Queen's County artisans listed there and visit them during the Queen's Coast art tour this year on June 22nd and 23rd. More than 40 artists, shops and pop-ups all over Queen's County are plotted on the map. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia has that story for us.
This thing comes with a paperclip because the best way to make a paper airplane is if you got a paperclip to put on the... Yeah, it's very important to have the paperclip. You know, when you do that and you pull it back and you get the nose, right, you put the paperclip here. And you will get a much better flying machine. Yeah.
That's stained glass artist Scott Slesser demonstrating one of the uses of the Queen's County art map. Making a paper airplane, though, isn't the most important part of the map. In fact, Slesser wants people to unfold it and find one of the many Queen's County artisans listed on it and pay them a visit during the Queen's Coast Art Tour. Slesser owns Sass Glass in downtown Liverpool. He and some other local artisans got together last year to form the Queen's County Arts and Crafts Society, taking over from the Queen's Arts Council. One of their first projects was to create an art map and studio tour. That happened last October, and it included a couple of dozen artisans from Liverpool to Western Head to Port Medway. This year, it's expanded to almost 40 artists, shops, and pop-ups all over Queen's County. And there will be two chances to participate in June and October. The first one is coming up on June 22nd and 23rd. The tour runs 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day. Slesser says it's all about promoting Queen's County as an arts destination and about artisans opening up their studios or demonstrating their craft to local residents and visitors.
I've been to a ton of these studio tour things, and what I've told everybody is, you know, it's just not another sale. You just don't put stuff on a table. You if you're painting, paint. You know, I'm glass. I'll be doing something with glass those days. People can come in. I can show them what I do, what the materials are, how I play with them. That has to be there because people do find that interesting. We need to be different. Everybody does craft sales, you know, up and down the shore, right? It's like one after another. So what's the difference? And I think the difference should be, you know, come on down, we're throwing some pottery, we're making some jewelry, we're, you know, you can see what we're doing.
Slesser says last October's art tour was a success for many of the artists, some of whom were surprised by how many people dropped by to see them in action.
I had 30 people each day in here. All I did was gab all day to people. And then I talked to other people who never really opened their studio, and they said, I can't believe all these people showed up in my studio, right? So it was kind of cool.
In addition to visiting artisans at their studios or workspaces, art lovers can also meet them at three pop-up locations, the Astor Theater, White Point Beach Resort, and Coastal Queens Place in Port Mattoon.
Some artists are very quiet and, you know, unassuming, and suddenly you find that there's this guy who's just right on the street here who's like a fantastic portrait painter, you know? You didn't even know it was there. And then you go, oh my God, that's right here, right? So, no, I think it's really important. And locally, I think it's important because last year, October when we did this, a lot of the folks who came around were local. And they were like, oh my God, I didn't even know. One of the longer term goals or wider goals of something like this is feel like you have a sense of community. And that you're not working totally in isolation, you know, because, you know, doing art can be a very, you know, isolating thing. And often that's a really good thing. You want it to be. To let them know that they have a kind of a community to be part of.
Aside from the obvious goal of giving artisans more chances to sell their work, another objective of the tour is to bring art lovers to the area from all over the province and beyond.
You know, in the perfect world, of course, I'd love to see artisans selling stuff and making some money. That's not necessarily realistic. I think if we bring people to the county, whether they buy from one of us or just spend time in a restaurant or, you know, going to the Astor or doing whatever, that's all positive.
Slessor says the Queens County Arts and Crafts Society has also applied for provincial funding to help them work on their online promotion. And he says he'd like to see international artists come to Liverpool for four-week residencies. The former diplomat has reached out to some of his contacts overseas.
It'd be great to have like a, I don't know, a Taiwanese artist here for 4 or 5 weeks. They'd be at the Astor. We would introduce them to other artisans. It'd be fun, right? Yeah. And informative and something totally different.
People can pick up a Queens Coast Art Tour map in Liverpool at the Visitor Information Centre, the Astor Theatre, Main and Mersey Coffee Bar, Shore Thing Studio and Emporium, or at Sass Glass just across from the Astor. You can also follow Queens Coast Art Tour on Facebook. I'm Rick Conrad.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
To the other end of the country now, a new study conducted by the University of British Columbia says it could be cheaper to allow the lake bed under Sumas Prairie to swell to its banks. It estimates it would cost $1 billion to acquire lake bed properties and to allow the Sumas Lake to return, versus $2.4 billion to harden flood mitigation infrastructure and prevent a replay of the November 2021 flood in the Fraser Valley. Author Riley Finn, a staff researcher at UBC's Martin Conservation Decisions Lab, estimated the cost using BC property assessment data overlaid with a map of the lake bed. The paper imagines a managed retreat using principles of Indigenous law developed by West Coast Environmental Law, a proposal that Abbotsford's Mayor Ross Siemens calls ridiculous. Mike McCullough is in Abbotsford, British Columbia.
Is getting out of the way of Mother Nature on Sumas Prairie cheaper and perhaps even justified? The authors of a University of British Columbia research paper probed this question, now nearly 3 years after the November 2021 flood and 100 years after the waters of Sumas Lake were drained to make way for the farms that dot the lake bed today. The paper's lead writer is Riley Finn. He's a staff researcher in UBC's Conservation Decisions Lab. Finn says the paper has three angles.
One of them was to really kind of situate the history of how Sumas Lake became Sumas Prairie. Then we wanted to get an understanding of, you know, what are the potential costs of returning the lake? And, you know, what does a potentially more inclusive process for determining the future look like? And so to get at those second two pieces, We looked at the assessed land values that come from BC assessments, and we overlaid historical mapping of the lake boundary on top of those.
Finn says to then determine a future with a restored Sumas Lake, the paper draws on the RELAW program,
which is revitalizing laws for land and water, which is a program run out of West Coast Environmental Law. And they worked a lot with First Nations and the Lower Fraser to kind of codify legal codes from oral histories and community dialogue.
My name is Murray Ned. Ancestral name is Klawasintin from Tsamath. And I guess a couple of capacities, Mike. I'm a former counselor for Tsamath First Nation, but I remain as an advisor to the nation, specific to this file. And then also I work for the Lower Fraser Fisheries Alliance as their executive director.
And Ned's family tree is directly connected to the opposition to draining the lake in the first place.
My late great grandfather was the chief back then. His name was Selsmilton. That was his ancestral name. And he was the one that opposed the lake back, well, the draining of the lake back in the 1920s, but they proceeded anyway. So
Ned worked closely with Finn on this paper.
We don't want to do the same kind of displacement that the nation and our ancestors that lived there before when the lake was drained. We know what it's like to be displaced. We know what it's like to lose that piece of the ecosystem. And today it's invaluable.
The paper explores a path where the Sumas Prairie becomes something of a hybrid of what the area looks like today, mixed with what it might have looked like a century ago.
There are stories from back when the lake still existed of, you know, cattle being grazed and crops being raised around the lake. So this was something that was occurring before the lake was gone. And I don't think it's unreasonable to imagine a future where, you know, you could have some of both with a more resilient to potential flooding events.
The lake was renowned for having all five salmon species plus steelhead and, you know, wildlife, elk running around here.
And how does a revitalized lake bed make inroads toward reconciliation?
We would be interested in return of the lake if it didn't have such an impact on the local people. And so perhaps what we're after is maybe something in between that doesn't affect the people and the agricultural industry as much. And if there's, you know, willingness for people to think about a bit of a transformation from what we're doing today.
The study estimates a managed retreat buying up lake bed properties would cost about $1 billion, less than half of the $2.4 billion cited by the paper to bolster flood mitigation infrastructure.
So when we looked at kind of the overlay of the lake bed with the surrounding properties, we found that the assessments data attached to kind of the parcels in the region were about $1 billion in terms of the assessed values. And so, yeah, those might be different than what the market values are, but, you know, the data we have is the BC assessments data. So that's what we found looking at kind of a broad area in terms of the lake bed as well as the surrounding floodplain around it.
Politically, Abbotsford Mayor Ross Seaman says the concept is a non-starter.
Not on my watch.
Seaman thinks the report has, quote, so many inconsistencies, end quote.
Just based on reality, but I would invite people to come and take a look at what is happening on Sumas Prairie and get your head in the game. That is not a no-go in my estimation.
Seaman says protecting the farmland on the Sumas Prairie is critical.
Well, this is the most valuable farmland in the country, the most productive. The fact is, where do we find arable land like that anywhere else in the province? So our food security, number one, this is people's livelihoods. These are third, fourth generation farmers that are now responsible for, you know, 50 to 60% of our dairy and poultry in the entire province of British Columbia are coming out of Abbotsford, and a vast majority of that's coming out of that prairie. People have invested their livelihoods, are here, their homes. That is just absolutely ridiculous.
When it comes to food security, Ned draws a through line from today to the past.
It's an irony. To me, as a nation member, it's an irony. They determined it was feasible to drain the lake back then and get rid of the food security that they had in the form of the lake. And then today, you know, they're talking about hanging on to industry and all the economic and livelihood considerations that occur with that. So, you know, I guess what we're looking at is trying to figure out a balance between what we have today and what we had in the past.
Let's not forget that British Columbia has to import food too. It's a two-way street. We can't just rely on others to be supplying our food. That is absolutely, you know, in today's changing world, when people are trying to protect their own areas, I mean, for us to just cut loose on food security is, you know, that is just a ridiculous notion from my perspective.
Finn says the paper tries to imagine a future where a version of Sumas Lake could be an economic engine for the Fraser Valley.
Like tourism and recreation and how the value of the lake might bring people to the region in terms of, you know, the economically important species that it might support, such as salmon and sturgeon. You know, what is the value of recreational fishing and food and ceremonial fisheries for the nations, as well as commercial fisheries that the lake might help produce. So there are lots of potential knock-on positive effects that, you know, we would have to essentially spend quite a bit of time trying to model out in order to get a proper idea of, you know, what are the costs and benefits.
We want it to be productive. We want the water to be healthy. We want the associated species, salmon and other wildlife, to be able to utilize it in a good way.
For now, Mayor Siemens is unambiguous.
Just to assure that my residents that I've got their back on this one, and I will go to the wall on that.
As for Finn, he's not fazed when confronted with opposition to the premise of a revitalized lake.
Our lab looks at decision science, and so, you know, really getting a broad view of the potential alternatives and considering, you know, what are the values that we're really trying to achieve. I think we just kind of saw that the broadest set of alternatives weren't really being considered, and there might be value in, you know, bringing a broader discussion.
This story was made possible by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. For this story and more, visit frequencynews.ca. I'm Mike McCullough.
Hello, I'm Andrew Dow in Six Nations, Ontario. You are tuned into Viewpoints.
A documentary on Indigenous astronomy expert Wilfred Buck hit the screens in Kingston this week on Friday, June 21st, featuring a Q&A with director Lisa Jackson. The documentary film tells the life story and shares the knowledge of Indigenous astronomy expert and educator Wilfred Buck, also known as the Star Guy. Adapted from his memoir entitled I Have Lived Four Lives, the film combines archival footage, dramatic reenactments, and present-day reportage to share Buck's story. Journalist Christina Laurie spoke with Jackson to learn more. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
Wilfred Buck, the man, is really an incredible person, and I was so privileged to make a feature film about his life. And the film basically is called a hybrid documentary because I follow his work today as an Indigenous star knowledge expert. But as well, I created scenes of his life growing up, and those are based on an incredible memoir he's written called I Have Lived Four Lives. And so the story of Wilfred Buck's life is extremely dramatic, harrowing, exciting, funny. And when I read his life story, I had to bring it to the screen. So what people will see is a film that I think is ultimately hopeful, and that takes you into the life of someone who has made a huge impact bringing Indigenous science to communities and helping people heal.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like you're saying, his life and legacy in itself is inspiring and fascinating and makes you want to make a movie about it. But what made you go, okay, this has to be on the big screen?
You know, what made me think that this has to be on the big screen was reading his autobiography. It has these stories that just leapt off the page. And I would say even the way he wrote it, the sort of voice that he used, his writing style, made me feel like I was reading one of the beat poets. Like, it's so like rhythmic and funny and just, it's like a wild adventure. It's just this wild ride. And so what made me feel like it had to go to the big screen was that I could see these stories from his life just playing out like a feature film almost. And so that's exactly what we did, is that we hired actors and set dressers, and we recreated these moments from Wilfred's life, starting when he was a kid up in northern Manitoba, to a period of time where he was, you know, addicted and homeless and going through all these things, and then finding his way back to his culture and ceremony and his Cree community. And so that's why I wanted to put it on the big screen. And I have to say, as a personality, I just still, like, people can't get enough, and I'm the same. I just find what he has to teach is so profound, but also he's so charismatic and funny and warm that it's worth spending an hour and a half with him on the big screen.
After you sort of decided, okay, I'm going to make this film, what was sort of the process to get us here, where it's, you know, being premiered and you're basically on tour with it?
Well, I say about this film, I was shaping the film and the film was shaping me. And so it did take a few years, and I felt like it really required me to immerse myself, not just in all the facts of Wilfred's life, but also about these really profound teachings that he has about the stars and about traditional knowledge. And a lot of that knowledge, people may know, was driven underground by colonization. And in fact, a lot of ceremonies were outlawed. A lot of cultural practices were outlawed from the late 1800s until the mid 1900s, 1951. And so there's been a reclamation that's been going on, which really got going in the 1970s, but is built and built. And Wilfred's a big part of that. And so I think that being able to spend that time with Wilfred and with the teachings that he's one part of bringing back to Canada has really been a great privilege. And basically, I wanted to do right by it. And I really hope I did. Yeah.
And you mentioned his teachings there. And I was wondering if you could get a bit into, you know, that Indigenous knowledge of stars and astronomy. And also, this is in partnership with Queen's University. So I think we all have a lot to learn.
Yeah. You know, Wilfred will say about the stars specifically, he'll say, you know, growing up, I never sort of thought about that anyone else looked up at the night sky, because all we hear about are the Romans and the Greeks and those stories and those names for the constellations. But part of what Wilfred brings specifically around the star knowledge is that every culture on the face of the earth looked up at the night sky, and every culture on the earth made stories to do with the night sky, but also knew how to read the night sky. And so some of the teachings that he shares, and, you know, we put a certain amount of them in the film. There's a lot more, of course, where they came from, but they are about how do we have knowledge in the night sky about how to navigate. There's stories about the way that, you know, moose kind of move around when you're hunting them, and those stories are put into the stars. There's stories about, like, the moose spirit and the way that it moves, but it tells you something about the way moose behave, you know, on Earth. But as well, there are really profound stories that I think are deep wisdom about how we live our lives. And some of those stories just tell us about, you know, my favorite is the Sturgeon star constellation. And, you know, I can't tell it as well as Wilfred, but it really talks about the importance of our responsibility over, like, seven generations, essentially, and how if we want to create a family and ancestors, if we want to be good future ancestors, then it matters how we behave right now. And so I think that from navigation to knowing about the natural cycles of the world around us, spring, summer, fall, winter, how do you live in harmony with the land, and to how we live together in harmony with each other as good people, all that stuff was kind of written in the stars. But I would say even beyond that, one of the things that I came to realize with Wilfred is that a lot of times Indigenous cultures, different cultures, they're talking about the same thing as Western science. They're just using a different lens or terminology. And so I think one of the things this film is highlighting and asking people to consider is if we could open our minds a little bit more, because a Western scientific perspective is sort of the mainstream, quote unquote mainstream. But sometimes we don't know how to listen to knowledge that comes in different forms, like stories. And I think one of the really profound, thought-provoking pieces that Wilfred brings to us is asking us to open up our minds a little bit and to look at the different forms that knowledge comes in. And I think when we do that, it allows us to see there's a lot of connections between different perspectives, whether that's Western science and Indigenous knowledge, or any ways of looking at the world. And I think when we do that, it brings us together and it creates community rather than division, you know, and that's always important.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
And we close this edition of Viewpoints in Wellington County, Ontario, where a new exhibit from the Wellington County Museum and Archives comes as the new Senate of Canada report urges action to protect Canadian soils. It was no coincidence that the new Senate report is being followed by the opening of the new exhibit, Not Just Dirt, Digging into the Science of Soil. Senator Rob Black attended the opening of the exhibit and says it is a perfect fit, given that a big component of the Senate's report recommendations is education. It also calls for a national soil strategy and the appointment of a soil advocate. Black says the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations warns we have just 26 years to protect the world's soil, or we won't be able to grow food. Kate Stockman in Fergus, Ontario.
The Wellington County Museum and Archives' latest exhibit takes a look at soil. Just as a new Senate report warns we have only 26 years to protect our soil before it degrades to the point we can't grow food. The new exhibit is called Not Just Dirt, Digging into the Science of Soil. Senator Rob Black sits on the Standing Committee of Agriculture and Forestry, which just released its report, Critical Ground, Why Soil is Essential to Canada's Economic, Environmental, Human, and Social Health. Black attended the opening of the exhibit on Saturday and says it is a perfect fit given the report's recommendations for the federal government.
Education was a big piece of some of the recommendations and what we heard, and so this is a piece of that. So I'm really excited.
In all, there are 25 recommendations in the report.
We want the government to acknowledge that soil is a national asset that needs to be protected. We expect that we would appreciate the government identifying a soils advocate, somebody who will cross this country and advocate for soil health and healthy soils.
The report comes 40 years after a similar Senate report, and Black warns the government needs to act quickly.
We also acknowledged in as a recommendation that the government doesn't have another 40 years. We need to get this right now because, as I mentioned, the FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, says that if we don't start doing something by 2050, which is 26 years from now, 90% of our soil could be degraded to the point where we can't use it.
Soil is also an important component of mitigating climate change. Black says it does so much for our environment.
Soil helps to clean our water, clean our air. It's a foundation of all the food we grow. And 95% of our food comes from the soil. So if we can't grow food, we're in deep trouble.
Karen Chisholm, the Climate Change and Sustainability Manager for Wellington County, played a big role in curating the exhibit. She says while soil releases carbon dioxide, healthy soil also traps it.
What we want to do is create these soils that are very healthy, that are going to be trapping as much carbon as we can, and the plants and whatnot use that carbon as well. So it's good for the plants, it's good for the environment.
The exhibit at the Wellington County Museum and Archives is open now. You can find a link to the Senate report in our story on frequencynews.ca.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints this week. Thanks to our journalists, Rick Conrad, Mike McCullough, Kate Stockman, and Christina Laurie. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Remember to write radio@frequencynews.ca. Thanks for being with us this week, and until the next, ciao. We'll be right back.
questions or comments, our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.